Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 12th of August. Our guest this hour is the author of What's Math Got to Do with It? Helping Children Learn to Love Their Least Favorite Subject and Why It's Important for America. Our guest is Professor Joe Bwalar, Marie Curie Professor of Mathematics Education at the University of Sussex in England, previously a professor at Stanford University, lecturer at King's College, London, and also a classroom teacher in London and California. She's a regular contributor to TV and radio in this country and the UK, and her research has appeared in newspapers around the world, including the Wall Street Journal and the Times of London. Some interesting statistics here. Year, the United States ranks 28th out of 40 countries in a study that looked at math performance around the world. And when the level of spending on education was factored in, the U.S. sank to last. The number of math majors at four-year colleges dropped 19% over the last 10 years. Those who are non-resident students received 44% of all master's degrees, 35% of all bachelor degrees in math. Four out of every 10 adults say they hated math in school. Twice as many people hated math as any other subject. And this one, by 2008, America will have generated 20 million more jobs for people who are mathematical problem solvers. But it's estimated that 60% of all new jobs in the early 21st century will require skills that are possessed by only 20% of the current workforce. So we're happy to have Joe with us, and our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Like to send an email about your math experience or your child's math experience or the math wars that seem to be going on, we'd love to hear from you at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah. So this book is wonderful because you go into some of these classrooms that are truly inspirational, and students are doing very well, and yet there's a fight against it. There is a thing called the math wars that are going on. Can you tell me what those are? Why would there be a war when some students are just blossoming with a non-traditional approach?
Well, it's a group of very traditional people who want to keep math as it's always been. So even though it's failed so many hundreds of thousands of people in America and in other countries, and so many people hate math and dread it, and it causes them great fear and anxiety, they want to keep it in a traditional form that other subjects don't use and that we know is ineffective. We know that from lots and lots of research. So it's very interesting that this traditional group, they move around the country, and every time they hear the school that's moving away from very traditional math teaching, they land in the area and campaign and do all sorts of strange things to try and keep math traditionally taught.
You start the book with an experience in California, a math lesson that you said that you would never forget, and the math wars eventually wind themselves into this discussion. What did you see?
Well, it's a fantastic teacher. She's an amazing teacher. She'd won awards. She won the presidential award from President Bush as being one of the greatest teachers in the country. And she'd basically teach math through a problem-solving approach, giving students really interesting problems, and they would talk about them, present ideas to each other. She would do some of the sort of telling them how to do things, and they would also discuss math. So it was absolutely fantastic approach. And it was one of the classrooms that was targeted by the what I've come to call the anti-knowledge group, because they try and suppress knowledge of good teaching methods. So they targeted the school, and now she's left teaching because of that.
Has she really? Oh, how sad.
Yeah,
and there was all this misinformation spread that if you went to her class, you weren't going to be able to get into colleges.
That's right. They told one of the lies this group told the parents. They gathered parents together and they told them, if your child follows this problem-solving approach to math, they won't be eligible for college. So that's just an out-and-out lie. But it spread all around the community. Of course, people were very afraid by that. And that led them eventually to say, okay, let's get rid of it, because they were so scared of that possibility, when actually it was just completely wrong.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the fear and anxiety that accompany math. Mm. Why is it that we, and I'll bet 90% of our audience has felt that way about math classes. Mm-hmm. Why is that associated with math and not other subjects?
Well, it's because of the fake version of math that's taught in schools, a really awful version that's nothing like the math of the world. It's nothing like the math that mathematicians use. It's really this strange set of rituals that we put children through that are very painful. And so math, first of all, is taught in a very boring way, and it's just follow me, watch me use lots of procedures, then use them. Then people are put under pressure to perform quickly, and that often makes you freeze in math. That's one of the things that math does, is when you put under pressure, your mind goes blank.
Mm-hmm.
So then most children are not able, I mean, that's sort of math teaching that's just sort of follow me, do these procedures and do lots of them, appeals to very few people, and also very few people are good at that sort of teaching. And so most people come to believe that they're not good, and they just associate math classes with repeated failure. As soon as they believe they're not good at it, their performance will go down. But actually, in classrooms where people teach real mathematics, which is the whole breadth of the subject, instead of this very narrow version, then many more students are successful, many more students enjoy it. It's really something that we know very strongly from research, and yet, unfortunately, the country continues in this teaching this very narrow, very traditional version that's quite traumatic for hundreds of thousands of people.
I'm sure. One of your chapters is titled, What is Math? How do students answer that, and how do you answer that?
Well, students typically will answer, American students will typically, if you ask them what math is, will say it's lots of rules and methods that you have to remember. Or they'll say it's about numbers, but they'll also say it's just lots and lots of rules to remember. And, of course, that isn't math at all. When we look at what math is in the world or in work or in mathematicians, it's actually a very broad subject. So it involves things like asking questions. That's one of the most important things to do in math. But sort of asking, posing a problem. Students can go through their whole lives in math classes without ever posing a problem. They're just answering somebody else's that they don't really care about. So in real math, there's posing problems, and then there's representing ideas in different forms. You have to be able to use words and drawings and graphs and symbols and moving between different representations and making connections. And talking is very, very important in math. It's very important to reason and think through things and to be able to explain why things work. So a real math classroom would have students talking and trying out different things and posing their own problems and using different representational forms. And that's what mathematics really is. And when it's taught in those ways, people are very successful.
You talk about the math of life, work, and leisure, and you present some wonderful examples here. Is intriguing and much more enjoyable than what we learn in class. Tell me how it's much more intriguing.
Well, really, most mathematicians, if you ask them what math is, will tell you it's the study of patterns, and it's looking at patterns in the world. And, of course, in the world, mathematics is all around us, and it's not only something that's sort of all through the internet and really useful in life, but it's in nature as well. So the way that petals are formed or pine cones, the way that sort of bees operate in hives, they all work in very patterned ways, and actually it's noticing those patterns in life, which is really one of the most essential aspects of mathematics, and seeing how it's a subject that helps us interpret the world and helps us understand what's going on in the world. Yet school children would never really think of it in those ways. And it was interesting, I was reading a quote the other day from the star of Numbers, the TV show Numbers, which is very popular in the States. And the sort of heartthrob star of that show was saying that he'd flunked algebra twice in school, but when he was introduced to the Fibonacci sequence in as part of his acting role, he could just never see math in the same way again, and it really changed him. He started to see the world differently, and that math has that power, really, to give people whole new insights into the world, which is why it can be so fascinating and so interesting.
you write about the golden ratio number, and then you look at the body and seeds in nature and the pyramids and the Parthenon and the UN building. I had never learned that. I never thought about that. Of course, that would change the way you see the world.
That's right. And like the golden ratio is one of these really interesting things about maths, that it's fascinating that out there, so many things exist in this same ratio, which has come to be known as the golden ratio, because it's in nature, it's in all sorts of things. As you say, the human body is built in that ratio, but also the way petals are formed and pine cones are formed, all sorts of things have this same ratio, which is called the golden ratio, and people use it in art and architecture. So, yeah, that's one of the really interesting things about math, that you could go through years and years of math classes and not even know that it exists. That's pretty typical, and that's just one of the indications that we teach a very impoverished and narrow version of math in schools, that people sort of can go through classes without knowing anything about these things.
Tell me about these jobs. This statistic is amazing because the economy is bad and we have all these jobs available for people who are mathematical problem solvers. Mm-hmm. But as you write, 60% of all new jobs in the early 21st century will require skills that are possessed by only 20% of the current workforce.
That's right, yeah. And that's not my statistic. That's a government statistic that they brought out. That was actually in the Glenn Report, which was a report on mathematics that was written sort of about the crisis we have in mathematics. And they sort of have done this analysis of the workforce and what's needed in the workforce and what's needed in the workforce sort of ahead of us. And so that's in a report that was commissioned, and it came out in 2000. It's called Before It's Too Late, a report to the nation from the National Commission on Mathematics and Science Teaching for the 21st Century. And so a very interesting report, and really just painting the picture of the crisis that's lying. It's not even ahead of us, really. It's really here, where many, many people, many jobs require math, and not just high-level jobs either. I mean, there is a crisis in that there's not enough people who are high-level math users to go into the jobs that are needed to keep sort of science and technology going, but even just people in everyday jobs, in all sorts of different jobs, are needing to use mathematics and to be mathematical problem solvers.
Even to be able to read the newspaper.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a strong argument that you can't be a powerful citizen, even just somebody who has full control over their lives, unless you're mathematically capable, and that means, you know, being able to interpret financial reports, being able to read newspapers, understanding weather reports, even being able to administer medicine to children. I have young children, and I always notice how you really need to be comfortable with numbers when you're sort of converting between different things is such important things as medicine. But, yeah, and it's nothing short of criminal, really, that people leave school without feeling completely comfortable with things like percentages and fractions. Those are basic mathematical methods that I and lots of people could teach to absolutely anybody and have them really feeling good about them and using them fluently. Mm. But we know that most adults stumble even with those sort of very important methods.
How did math become your profession?
Well, for me, actually, I was always very interested in the learning of mathematics. When I was at school, I was fairly good at math. It wasn't that I didn't ever experience problems. I used to get stuck on all sorts of things, but I was fairly good at it. But I used to notice that people really hated it and really struggled, and I just didn't think that teachers were that good at explaining it when I was at school. I kept thinking, well, you know, it'd be really good if they said this, or if they helped people get insights by doing this. So from an early age in school, I was interested in sort of teaching and learning mathematics, and I helped my school, my best friend who wasn't so strong in math, get through the advanced math course that we did together.
Oh, and great.
So when I left university, I decided to teach mathematics, and that was what I did initially. I was a teacher of mathematics, and then I did a master's course in the learning of mathematics, and then a PhD, and went into academia. So I was a lecturer in England, and then moved to California, where I was a professor at Stanford.
Mm-hmm. And you've done studies. Tell me what you found. They are long-term studies of students, I think starting in middle school, to see if you're exposed to some of these more vibrant methods of teaching, what happens to you in the course of your math studies.
Yeah, so I'm unusual as a researcher in mathematics in that I follow students over a long period of time. A lot of researchers will just drop in on students and give them a test and go away and use those methods. I've actually conducted two long-term studies now. I've followed students through 3 years of different schools in England, and then in California I followed students through 4 years of different schools. And in those studies, I've always looked at different teaching methods and really stayed with students, watching classes, watching them learning, watching the teaching, and assessing them in lots of different ways to see how the teaching has affected them. And both of those long-term studies have shown the same findings, which are that students who are taught in the very narrow traditional way of a teacher stands at the front of the classroom, shows methods, and they have to practice them over and over in their books, are turned off mathematics and don't do very well in it compared to schools that really engage students in the breadth of mathematics, have them talking about methods, about why they work, have them looking at really interesting problems, and very critically engage them in problem solving instead of just repeating methods which, you know, don't mean much to children. Actually engage them in hard problems where they have to apply methods and think about making connections between different areas of mathematics. And so in those more active classrooms where students are more actively engaged and they're talking, solving problems, and seeing math as a much broader subject, then they every time do better. They do better in all sorts of applied assessments that they might need in the world, but they also do better in traditional tests. They go further in math. The study I conducted in California, the students who are engaged in the more applied problem-solving approach were 10 times as likely to take math to higher levels.
Oh, my.
10 times as many of them took it to advanced levels. And that is a critical area for the country as well, that not enough students are going to advanced levels. So there's really no downside to that, that good teaching. We know it works. We know it's very successful. Yet it doesn't take place in many schools in America, unfortunately.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. Our lines are already filled. We're speaking about math this hour of the program and with the author of What's Math Got to Do with It? Helping Children Learn to Love Their Least Favorite Subject and Why It's Important for America. Professor Joe Bwalor is with us, Marie Curie Professor of Mathematics Education at the University of Sussex in England. She also was a professor at Stanford University, a lecturer at King's College London, and a classroom teacher in London and California. Her research has appeared in newspapers all over the world, actually, Wall Street Journal, The Times of London, and she's done quite a few long-term studies of students who've been exposed to a more exciting, involved kind of math instruction and what that does to their long-term interest in the subject. All right, to your phone calls in a moment, 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. And we also have this email. You can use it. You've been quiet on it today. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now, starting with Michelle from Stoughton. Hi, Michelle.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I identify so much with this topic. I had a terrible experience when I was in high school. I had been interested in algebra and had a very good teacher, and so then I moved on to geometry, and the geometry teacher she would say, well, does anybody have any questions? And you'd ask her a question, and she would say, well, you should have asked me that last week.
Oh, no.
And then she wouldn't answer the question. And she would also go around the room when we got our report cards, and she would say, she would look at the grades you got in other classes and then tell you that you had obviously been working harder in other classes and not her class. Mm. And she pretty much did me in for math for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then later on, as I got a little bit older, you know, I started to use math in other ways and started to like it again. but it was, it developed my theory that a lot of teachers go into math because they like it, but they really don't know how to relay that information to the students.
Joe, you want to respond?
Oh, well, yeah. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there.
So I think it's really great you've raised that, because, you know, it's so true that people have terrible experiences with math. I've interviewed students who've had terrible experiences, and then they use math in the world, and they said to me, why did school misrepresent it so badly? It's actually, you know, quite an interesting subject. So I'm glad you raised that issue. And terrible. One teacher can do that to you, as you say, and that is the thing about mathematics that's different to other subjects, or maybe it's more extreme in math, is that there is a psychological element that if somebody gives you the idea you're not good at it, things can just go downhill from that point. And that's really what we do to most children in math classes. We communicate the idea that they're not very good at it. And you also, I think you raised another point about teachers too, that there are lots of people who go into math teaching because they liked math, and actually they liked that very traditional model that I've talked about. There were some of the very few people who liked that, and so that model just continues. And unfortunately, sometimes they don't. I had math teachers when I was at school who didn't understand students not understanding. We would ask questions, and he would say, "What do you mean you don't understand?" Which also was doesn't help you. So, yeah, that's the situation. Exactly what you describe is what we need to change. That's the hard problem.
And what do you think about math now, Michelle? Have you advanced?
Well, no, I haven't advanced, but I use it in my job, and I've used it in other jobs, and I learned to like it again with a little bit different attitude. But, you know, that judgmental business just can't be in there. You have to be a little more expansive and a little more... you know, let yourself make mistakes, for one thing, so you can learn it.
Yeah, mistakes are absolutely critical to learning. That's one of the first things I say when I'm working with someone over math, is like, I love it if you make mistakes. It's so great if you make mistakes, because that's how we learn. And by making a mistake and thinking through it, and mistakes as well, they're never just random. They're actually somewhere in the mistake, there is some very logical thought process, and teachers can work with that. But, you know, that's not, unfortunately, how people view mistakes often. But one of the teachers I describe in the book, he starts with the, first of all, they have this very, very broad version of math. And what they find is when they make math really broad and they actually value all the different aspects of math, many, many more students are successful. But he starts with the idea that he is going to find all the ways that children in his class are smart. So even if he finds a student who really other people would think, oh, they're terrible at math, you know, they're getting everything wrong, I've seen him and he'll say, oh, that student's great in my class because he asks really good questions and they help everybody. And that's the way he works. He says, everybody in here is smart. I'm going to find the ways that they're smart.
And I like that.
His students do so well because of that.
That's great. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you very much.
Bye. We have an email from Tom from Milwaukee. He said that this is not the boom to education that it's presented as. At California, one of the first states to adopt the new way of teaching math in the early 90s, also one of the first to abandon it when 12 years later students were failing out of college at higher rates. It's not they weren't accepted to college, it's that they got stuck in remedial math courses that they never got out of because they couldn't add or subtract.
Do you want me to respond to that?
Please, yes.
Well, this is the fear of the you know, people who support very traditional teaching, that once you move into a more problem-solving approach, students then can't do basics. Now, I would say that what happened in the 80s was people realized that this very traditional model of teaching wasn't working well. Hundreds of thousands of people hate math and do badly in it and have done for a long time. But there was a big move to try other things, and that probably happened too quickly. So teachers weren't really trained very well. They weren't ready in lots of cases. And the ideas got communicated very quickly. So I'm sure there were some classrooms where they just thought, well, you know, now we can do other things in math and just sort of play games and not do a particularly rigorous mathematics teaching. There probably were some classrooms like that. But unfortunately, with the big move against that new movement, it's kind of thrown the baby out with the bathwater, because some teachers were actually moving in very positive directions and doing very good things, and we have the research evidence to show that. And so what would have been good, instead of saying, OK, let's go back to where we were before, what would have been good is if people sat down and said, OK, let's work this out. What actually is working? What was working from old methods? What's working from these newer methods? Let's have a good sort of look at them and see the most effective classrooms and get those going. But instead, there was just this huge sort of war started, as I mentioned. And so now people have gone back to very traditional teaching. Things haven't improved. You told everybody some pretty worrying statistics at the beginning of this show. We know there's widespread failure. Mm-hmm. Nothing's improved in California since the newer methods, since we've gone back to the traditional methods. So that's really the big problem, that people decided that the newer approaches weren't rigorous enough and just went backwards instead of saying, well, let's try and work things out.
Our number is 800-486-8655. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our guest is the author of What's Math Got to Do with It? Helping Children Learn to Love Their Least Favorite Subject and Why It's Important for America. We have one line open for you right now, so you may want to get it. And the email is talk@wpr.org. Eugene from Viola, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen, and to your guest. I taught elementary and also junior high math for a few years. And one of the things that I did, I taught as much mental math as I possibly could on a chalkboard. And it worked. For instance, an example, I was to teach the sixth graders, the seventh and eighth graders, how to multiply two-place numbers. Instead of starting on the right, start on the left and do it mentally. And you go straight up the first time, cross-multiply each way, and add two zeros the first time, and one the second, don't add any of the last. And one, if you worked on that mental math for a year, for a while, they once they caught on to that, they would come close on their answers. And they would know whether they were. It would teach them how to think with numbers. And if you show me a good carpenter and a good farmer, I will show you somebody that can think with numbers very well mentally. And they will come up with a good answer. They may not hit it on the head, but they'll know whether they're right or they're wrong. And another one, I always made them go back when they got their work done on their math. I always made them go back and correct their mistakes and find out where they made the mistakes and why what they did wrong. And not just little corrections. But a lot of times it's just minor errors that don't amount to an awful lot. Mm-hmm. And also, there's a good series, creative publications, comes out of Palo Alto, California. Your guest was mentioning patterns, and they put out a booklet on patterns. Patterns in math. Did an excellent job.
Joe.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I think mental math is very important. The only thing I would say is that when teachers are working with mental math, and I'm sure Eugene is one of these teachers, it's very important not to have sort of time pressure and pressure at all, really, with students. So they should be able to think about math sort of mentally, but do it in a way that's still with interesting problems and still without that kind of pressure. One of the approaches I describe in the book, which I've seen used to fantastic effect, is when teachers put up a problem on the board, like they might put up something like 16 times 8, and they say, okay, everybody try and work this out without pen and paper. And then instead of just moving to the right answer, they ask students to describe their methods. And what you'll typically get is like 5 or 6 different methods in the room if students are doing it in their head. And I've done this with students, and I've seen other teachers do it. And we've done that every day. And one of the things students have learned, they've got good at mental math from doing it in their head, but they've also seen that actually there are 5 or 6 different methods for doing it, and all of the methods are valid. They're very interested that actually there are different methods, because another problem with math teaching is that kids often get the idea there's just one way to solve something. So, yeah, I think mental math is great. It has to be done without time pressure and, as I said, and still valuing math in the sort of interesting way it is. And also looking for the reasons for mistakes. I would agree also that that's a good thing to do in lessons if it's done in the right way.
Yeah.
Again.
Thanks, Eugene, for the call. Another email, Mary from Shell Lake. I was a student who did well in algebra in spite of how it was taught. I could arrive at the correct answer, but seldom in the way that the teacher instructed us. I used my own approach to a formula, and it worked. I could never understand why we didn't explore the different ways of solving a problem instead of the right ways. Math became boring to me, and I hated it.
That's so important. That's exactly the point I was just making, really. It's so good to have different methods. And we taught at this. I describe in the book how we taught a group of 7th and 8th graders who'd failed math in a summer school in California when I was there. And they'd all come, it was so sad really, they'd all failed, they were very dispirited, they hated math, but they all had got this idea that there's just one way of solving problems, and actually their teacher wouldn't even let them use their own methods, and that's one of the worst things I find. So that's really great. It's great to be able to use a different method. And I can completely agree. One of the most interesting things you can do is look at different methods, see why they work, think about them, think about why some methods are used or some methods are faster. Or it's a very interesting thing to do. But as Mary said, that isn't what's done. Usually people just want the answer and then they move on. But, yeah, the teacher allows kids or even values the different methods that students are able to use and talk about, then that's a really good thing to approach to teaching. Mm-hmm.
Of all the subjects that we learn in school, of all the subjects there, it seems to me as though people say about math, and tell me if this is right or wrong, that you need to have, as you do with music, a special proclivity for math. You're either good at math or you're not.
Yeah, so I completely disagree with that. And Keith Devlin, who's a mathematician and very famous author, he's written lots of books, makes this point well. He has a book that's called The Math Gene, and he makes the point that the gene in our bodies for learning math is the same gene as the one for learning language. Everybody learns language. Everybody becomes fluent in their home language, yet they somehow feel they can't do math. That's absolutely wrong. I would sort of challenge anybody to give me a student that I can't get to do well in math up to a certain level. I don't think everybody can do, is probably suited to doing university math, but certainly basic mathematical ideas and methods, absolutely everybody can be comfortable with those and enjoy them. It's nothing to do with some special gene or any more than it is in any other subject area. It's really a lot to do with people's experiences as children that make the difference between being a math person and not a math person. And actually, other countries that don't have this idea that it's genetic, like Japan and lots of the Asian countries, do much, much better in math, and that's part of the reason they do so much better. They believe that success is due to hard work, and that anybody can do it. And that's a very, I think that's absolutely right, and it's a very important message for children.
Sure. Tom from Burlington, hi.
I read this this book several years, a long time ago. I found it in the Library of Congress, and it was about the connection between cluttering and stuttering and mathematics, and it had been translated from German into English. And what they said was they separated the brain between the frontal lobes and the back lobes, and they said that people with well-developed frontal lobes, like Mozart and Beethoven, were good with music, but they were not necessarily good with mathematics, even though the key of C is a mathematical, it's 220 vibrations per second. And they said that people who are good with the frontal lobes are good with languages and music. And then they divided it, people who are good in mathematics are good with visual things. And you just mentioned about in Japan, they have a very visual alphabet, and they're also good with mathematics. But Einstein, in particular, Einstein figured out his theory of relativity in language. He was really basically good in language, and then he translated it into mathematics. And as you pointed out further in your show, there are different ways people's minds do work differently, and they approach things differently. And as you say, you should open them up and use these other methods for approaching a problem. And my big problem in school was I could never understand how you could divide a big number into a little number. I just couldn't do it. But anyway, those are some thoughts.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Very interesting. I don't know I didn't know about those, whether that's still regarded as correct with the sort of latest brain research, that it's music goes with language, doesn't go with maths. And also, many, many mathematicians are actually very high-level musicians mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure about those associations, but I think when they're talking about people's sort of brain associations with, and they're talking about people like Einstein, they're really looking at people have gone to the very, very highest levels of sort of developing subjects. And I think for most of us ordinary people in the world, we all have the brain power and the right kind of brains to do the sort of mathematics that we ever need to do. It is interesting, the visual. I think mathematics, again, is a very visual, should be a very visual subject. When I was teaching those 7th and 8th graders I told you about, we did lots of work with the visuals of mathematics, looking at patterns, seeing algebra through visual representations and looking at all sorts of visual forms. And they said they'd never seen a mathematical idea visually before.
No.
Which, that's, you know, terrible to me. I mean, really awful. But, and again, that how does a big number go into a little number? The first thing I would do with a student is draw a picture and think about what these things look like visually. But again, that's part of sort of the idea that some people are suited for math. I think the very traditional version that's taught in most American classrooms is probably true. So only some people are suited to that, and very few people are suited to that. But if you teach real math, actually the whole breadth of the subject, there's so many different sort of aspects to it and different ways you can use it and see it that many, you know, everybody is going to be sort of, is going to connect with it when you teach that broad subject.
We're going to welcome more phone calls for Joe in a moment. We're talking with the author of What's Math Got to Do with It? Helping Children Learn to Love Their Least Favorite Subject and Why It's Important for America. Joe is the Marie Curie Professor of Mathematics Education at the University of Sussex in England. She also was a professor at Stanford University, a lecturer at King's College in London, and a classroom teacher in London and California. We have one line open if you'd like to grab it. The number is 800-486-8655. And in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls now, Boyd from Milwaukee. Hello.
Good morning, Kathleen, and hello to your guest. I pretty much just was going to, you know, with some of the previous callers where they had struggled in math, that was, you know, my experience in high school and even part of college. I had to take logic twice, you know, because it was just so overwhelming. But the life-changing experience for me, if you want to call it that, was I had a tutor. And she just had me look at math in a different way and said, you know, math is really about confidence. And if I would have had that approach in middle school, I have no doubt that my senior year in high school, I would have been doing calculus. And I think the problem is, if not directly, indirectly, in this country, we are taught we have to be afraid of math. And that really, people may not find that kind of odd, but it's true. We are being spooked by math. And one thing that your guest had said while I was waiting, which I also have to agree about, she made the connection between mathematics and linguistics. It's an interesting that she brought that up, because they've done tests where people who are very proficient in math and in linguistics, when they get when they get older, they have a lesser chance of going senile, because they're constantly exercising your brain like you would exercise your muscles when you lift weights, do calisthenics, what have you. And I just thought I'd share those thoughts with you, and I'll leave
it at that. Okay, Boyd. Thanks.
And that last one's very interesting. I mean, math does actually make you smarter. I mean, that's the other good reason for doing it, that working on math, and not those sort of boring lessons in school, but working on math puzzles, Sudoku, logic puzzles, jigsaws, actually makes it's like an exercise for the brain, as Boyd said, and it makes you smarter in your young life, in your adult life, and I'm sure that's right, that it stops you going senile as well. So there's lots of good reasons to do math, and that's why it's so tragic that so many people are turned away from it. Another also very important point about confidence, I think that's right. We are taught that we should be afraid of math. people have horrible traumatic experiences in math classes that make them afraid of it. It's not surprising that so many people are afraid of it, but that's really one of the main things that has to change in the system if we're going to improve and start sort of getting people enjoying math and achieving at the levels of students in other countries.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Daniel. I had a high school calculus teacher who refused to teach you how to do the problems before giving you the homework. She'd assign homework, tell you to read the book, grade the assignment the next day, then teach the class how to do the work. I couldn't understand why she would teach this way. 90% of her class failed through all the years I was in high school. What would be the real benefit to this kind of teaching?
Well, that's a tricky question. What would be the benefit? I don't know why the teacher would decide to do that.
No, neither.
It sounds very odd. You don't want to have to do homework problems on something that you don't know about. It might be nice to have some experience exploring ideas before you're taught them, but I don't think that's what that sounds like. It sounds pretty strange to me. So
uh-huh.
I don't think there's any educational theory or anything that that's developed from. It's obviously some quirk of that time.
Right,
that
teacher. You have a chapter about testing, and you talk about the testing system in the United States as being disastrous. Why?
Well, the testing system in America is so different to other countries. It's really quite horrific, the amount that students tested and the form of the test as well. I mean, in Europe, no country uses multiple choice tests. They're just not thought to be very valid assessments.
Hmm.
Some kids do very well on multiple choice tests and others don't, but that doesn't sort of correlate very well with actually who understands the work. But in America, nearly all of the tests are multiple choice. There's virtually nothing else, and in math in particular. So I've worked with great, when I was at Stanford and I was training teachers, lots of really great people who were going into teaching who could teach math really well and had lovely ideas, but they would go into schools and then come back and say, look, we can't do these great things. We've got to prepare the kids for the test. We've just got to, drill them in material so that they do well on these tests. So it really does damage the education system and what teachers can do in classrooms. But it's so, it's partly they're very narrow. Again, they're looking at particular just answering procedures. They're multiple choice tests. They're also very frequent. Lots and lots of the math teachers I worked with in the States used to give their children tests every week. So they're spending a lot of time taking tests. They're using negative experience where they don't get a very good mark. They don't know why they didn't get a very good mark. They then just move on to the next chapter. Mm. So it's just a sort of humiliating experience, really. It's not helpful in any way. So the way tests are used is really not good. I don't know how else to put it. It's not good, and it doesn't sort of go with what we know about good assessment and good learning.
Right. Mike is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hi. Hey, how are you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Good. I listening to this teacher, I wish I had a teacher like that when I was in school.
I do too.
Just the sound of her voice, I'd want to come to the class.
Nice, Mike.
I think really the big problem in this country is money. And Kathleen, I know you know about this, the political nature of, especially here in Milwaukee, where you have, because of the money crunch, there's a lot of teachers that are teaching who are not qualified to teach math and science, and they might have a minor in it, but they really wanted to teach English or something, But there they are, they're stuck in the class having to teach, and they're uninspired, and they might love the kids and that, but I don't know that there are that many math teachers that are really inspired. I have four kids that went through MPS, and one of them is going to school for engineering now, but and loves math because of a few good teachers in MPS that for him that really inspired him. But the thing is in this country, we've decided that our children and their education is not important, and other things are more important. And in China, they've decided that math and science is important, and they're spending billions of dollars in building universities. They want engineers and scientists. And I don't know how they're going to teach math on such a large scale. But the point is we can change that around. We can give these teachers what engineers and architects are getting, and get them those inspired people back in the schools again. And we could do that in this country if we. I mean, in this country, we have the worst infant mortality rate. We talk the talk, but we don't walk the walk. That's my point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's it. We do. There is a huge shortage in trained math teachers. That's true too, and it's all part of the same problem. When we turn kids off in school, they don't go further in math, and we end up with a shortage of teachers as well. Teaching in China is an interesting one. Mike, you're also right that we don't treat teachers very well. They're not paid well. They're not. They may have long summer holidays, but the actual job, lots of people will go into and then leave after a year because it's very high stress. It's not. People don't really get time. In China, math teachers teach for 8 hours a week. The rest of their time, they're planning lessons, working with other teachers. They have this really interesting sort of model of teacher development. So you teach for 8 hours a week, and the rest of the time, you're meant to be preparing these wonderful lessons and spending time in the library and developing, looking at resources and bringing them together. And then they work with each other and watch each other's lessons and help improve each other's lessons. And as you know, teachers in America, I mean, they're teaching, I don't know exactly the hours, it's like 5 hours a day of teaching math. They have no time to prepare interesting lessons. So they're very different conditions for teachers, and that certainly doesn't help the problem that teachers have pretty poor conditions in America. It's not a very attractive job for a lot of people. Interestingly, though, the Chinese teachers, there was a study done of the knowledge of American and Chinese math, elementary teachers, actually. And what they found was the American elementary teachers had a very poor understanding of math, but they had just been taught lots of the methods in school, and they were then just trying to teach methods to kids without properly understanding them. And in China, lots of the teachers hadn't done any more advanced mathematics at all. So there is the idea that they've done sort of lots of math and they're very well trained in math. That actually isn't, they are very well trained in math, not by going to high levels, but actually really understanding the math that they're teaching. So what they found was that elementary teachers had this very connected and broad understanding of the mathematics of elementary school. And so that really helped their students understand it, whereas the American teachers had actually got the same qualifications as the Chinese teachers, but they'd just been drilled in school, and so they weren't very effective. so, yeah, it is an issue, definitely, I think Mike's right about a lot of the conditions that teachers are in. And we are definitely faced with a situation now where there's a real shortage of qualified math teachers. Not all teachers who are teaching math who haven't got lots and lots of higher qualifications in math are bad teachers. Actually, some of the best teachers may only have a minor, but they might be really inspirational math teachers. So, but certainly we don't want to be in a situation where so few people are qualified to teach math, as is the current case in the States.
Thanks very much for the call. Amos is next from Sauk County. Hi, Amos.
Hi, Kathleen. I have 3 points. One is that if you really want good math education, you're going to have a much more challenging program for the kids who like math at younger years. I mean, much more. You don't take good athletes or good musicians and stick them in a classroom and expect everybody to learn at the same rate and end up with good athletes or good musicians. And the second point is that I guess math is a different subject from everything else, because for most people, some people love foreign languages, some people love history, some people love art. They love all kinds of things. And I know you're a mathematician, but I think unless math is something that we have yet to figure out how this works, a lot of kids just don't like math. And it doesn't matter how you teach them this. And you quote this study about 60% are going to need math. I mean, you know, I can just I don't have to look at the study to know that that is a bogus study, because the vast majority of people with calculators, they're doing very low-level math. We've gotten to the point where they don't even need to know fractions. But what people do need, I know enough addition and subtraction to know that we're spending $500 to $600 billion in the military every year. We've got, what, a $13 trillion debt. And you, Kathleen, you had a show on Pakistan the hour before. And I'm looking at education of kids, and I'm saying that the way out of our crisis as a society isn't to buy more into this mechanized, militaristic way of looking at our the way we're living. It's to broaden our social understanding, to broaden our knowledge of nature. All these things that kids will zero in on if we taught those effectively in school. I mean, history is life, and we're saying, oh, math is going to get us out of this. I agree. We need much higher quality math coming out of the schools for the people that have the aptitude for it. We certainly don't need to spend more time on trying to convince kids and parents that this math, which we all know we forget after we get out of school, and by the way, I was actually quite good at math, is essential to our survival of our society. I mean, I don't buy it.
Okay, we have about 10 seconds, Joe, that's all.
Okay, well, there's a lot I disagree with in that statement. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not about finding the elite. I mean, the elite can go off and do what they want to do at university. Everybody in school can have a really good understanding of math, and that might be right, people are using calculators, but that isn't math. That's not what I call math. And when they say that 60% of jobs need math, they mean that they need people who are good problem solvers and who can blend different types of information and can look at shape and estimation. And so, yeah, using calculators, I agree, lots of people use calculators, but they need people who are thinking mathematically about the world. So,
thank you, Joe. We're out of time. Thanks so much for being with us. Joe Baller, and you spell it B-O-A-L-E-R. The book is What's Math Got to Do With It? Helping Children Learn to Love Their Least Favorite Subject and Why It's Important for America. Thank you, Carmen Jackson, for producing the hour. John Treader on air production. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening.